Hey yo, and here we go. Welcome to another edition of We Talk Music. I'm Brett. I'm joined again by Mo.
Hello.
And today we have an extra special guest, the guitarist for Rocks Gang, LA Guns, Angels in Vain, and Let It Rock, Stacy Blades, a Calgarian.
Yeah, Calgary's own, Stacy Blades.
Yes.
There you go.
How's it going, eh? I couldn't resist.
Of course. Yeah, so we originally tried to do this interview with you a week ago and last Tuesday. And I was sitting there, I was actually working on a project and I was under a deadline. And my phone rings and I pick it up and somebody says, hey, is this Brett?
Where the hell are you guys?
And
I used the wrong day, dude.
And I'm sitting there, I'm like, Brett? Who the hell's calling me? And so I'm like, no. And then you list off the number. And I'm like, this is not even close, because I'm looking at it, I'm thinking it's my own phone number. Or my cell phone number, not realizing you're calling on the Skype. And I'm thinking to myself, A, this guy's either some rip-off artist trying to scam me, or it's B, it's some guy who's, because you lead it off to me, and it's like 710. I don't even know what my Skype number is. And my actual number starts with 403. And I'm like, it's not even close. I'm like, how stupid. Like, if he had dialed 402, I would have understood. How does he confuse 710? I hang up the phone with you, and I... sitting there going, huh, you asked for Brett, what are the odds of that? A couple seconds later.
And it's funny because your Skype number is a San Diego number, and I called it on my Google number. And some guy answered, and I'm like, Brett, what's going on? I'm ready for the interview. He's like, who?
Yeah, I'm sitting there. I put
isn't
it
this
down.
This number? Yeah, like, the guy's like, not even close.
I'm sitting there, I'm going, okay, so I think that might have been on the Skype. All right. Couple more seconds go by. I go, huh? We're supposed to interview Tracy or Stacy Blades tomorrow there, and I'm like, huh? I just blew off Stacy Blades. Five more seconds go by, and then I go, fuck! I run to the room, hand Brett the phone. Hope you're gonna answer, and I haven't totally blown it off. So I apologize. I was so rude. Like I said, I wasn't expecting your call. It was all my fault. And I was literally.
We're on the blower today, so we're.
I'm really sorry about that. Like I say, I could have handled it better. I just figured somebody's trying to rip me off here.
Another telemarketer.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I'm like, I bet you'd be good at it though. So, you tend to because you hustle. I mean, that's the one thing we notice about you. I mean, you're. I think I saw a quote from you said that like a shark, you got to keep swimming or else you're gonna die. I mean, you do.
I mean, that's always kind of been my motto, you know, and it's like the music business is just, you know, everybody thinks it's, you know, peaches and whipped cream, and it's so far from it. It's really a tough business just dealing with people and in the industry and, you know, all the travel and just everything that goes along with it. Now, granted, it is the best job in the world but everything that goes into that hour or that 45 minutes or that hour and a half you put your time on stage, it's like I wouldn't trade it for the world, but there's so much that goes into it. But that's another story, you know.
Well, one of the biggest reasons that we wanted to talk to you, besides the fact that you're Canadian, but is the fact that Calgary's own, is actually the reason because, as a Canadian, you really intended to go down to the States to play. You tried your very best to kind of get out of Canada to go there, and to start playing with those bands.
Yeah, you know what's funny is something I talk about, you know, I'm going to get deep here. I talk a lot about this, and I'm really, really into metaphysics, and it's really about law of attraction. Whether you believe it or whether you practice it or don't know anything about it, it's always working. And what you project, if you do it over and over and over and over and over again, the things will line up in the universe for you. So, and I look back and I go, wow, you know, I wanted to be in a band just like Rocks Gang and LA Guns. And here's a kid that, you know, grew up in Toronto.
What?
And you know, moved to LA, moved to Florida in the early 90s, moved to America, which was a goal number one. Okay, moved to America to play music. And I look back, was in both of those bands. Like, there, it really does work. It completely works. You know, I busted my ass to make all that happen over the last 26, 7, 8 years, however many years it's been now. But if you do practice that, you know, you'll be amazed what you can accomplish. So that's kind of a unique thing, and it's exactly goes what you were talking about. My focus was that, as great as the Canadian music industry was and or is still, tremendous amount of great bands, it was very limited in a way. Like, record companies in the late 80s, they would have never signed a band like Guns N' Roses or LA Guns or anything like that. It was very safe, and I just always figured, you know what, if I'm going to have a music career, a long-lasting one, I'm going to have to go to America, which is exactly what I did. So.
So if we can talk a little bit more about how you got down there. I know it was your answer to an ad. Roxgam was looking for guitars. You've been playing in Canada. There was a band called Frady Cat, which is Frady and then K-A-T-T. So to me, that...
You have to have... That's very 80s, early 90s thing. You had to have not just one T, but you had to have two T's.
That's metal. That's... We're like, that's... We wanted to steal that name for something, but it looks like we got some... the demos have come out now, and we'd probably get sued. But that was just a perfect name. But you look in through Metal Edge, and there's an advertisement for the Rock Stands looking for a guitarist. Now, you got down there, you nailed the audition, and you go down there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could tell me a little bit more about the process, about the audition, what it was like, how they kind of welcomed you both for the audition and for the band when you came in and played on that first album. Were you just kind of like a hired gun at first? Or were you nervous on the audition? Did they make it easy for you? How did it go?
You know, when they got my press kit, you know, within a couple of days of talking to their management, you know, when they called me back within 2 days, I knew I had a really good shot because they were like, yeah, the band really likes your style. We listened to the demo tape, and I had sent them, I think it was a Frady Cat demo, and it was a really, really good demo, very well produced and great sounding and good songs. You know, that and a great picture that I had done a photo shoot not too long before that. So I already kind of had my foot in the door. So that was a good sign when I got that phone call that quick after that. And I was just like, well, I'm getting this. I don't care whatever I got to do, I'm getting this gig. I was very excited about it because I was really into Roxanne. I thought they were a great band. First record's phenomenal. It was exactly what I was looking for. So I went down there very, very prepared. And it's funny because I got so sick before I left. It was like, I remember there was a place where I worked at downtown Toronto. There was this wicked flu going around, and I'm like, no, I can't get sick. And sure enough, the night before I left for Tampa, I got so sick. And then my flight was delayed 5 hours, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this can't happen. This is not, you know. But anyways, I got down there, and I was super sick, but I came in, and I looked great, and I nailed the audition. We did like 5 or 6 songs. And they just took a shine to me right off the bat. And I got home, and I think 4 or 5 days later, they called me and said I had the gig. And I kind of knew I did really well because, you know, I was so prepared and I had wanted it so bad that it really translated from the time I went in there. There was some other guys auditioning, of course, and there was, you know, guys that had taken buses from, like, you know, Dallas and all these other places. But it was chemistry kind of right off the bat. So that felt good when we played together for the first time.
So what did you play during the audition? Was it Rock Skank songs or?
Yeah. It was, I think we did, so long ago. I think we did Scratch My Back, Fastest Gun of Town, Ball and Chain. Those three I do remember. It was so long ago. I think it was like that or in maybe 9 Lies or something. I can't remember, but those three I do remember.
Some of the faster tracks then?
It was Fastest Gun in Town, Scratch My Back, Ball and Chain. Maybe it was Red Rose, too. I think Red Rose, maybe we did play that, too. Yeah,
that is that's a great song. Awesome song.
Great song.
So you're down there. Now, when they bring you into the gang, like I say, into the band.
Into the
gang, a little bit of both. So are you the youngest member of the band?
I was at that time, yeah. Gosh, I was 23 or 4. Just full of piss and vinegar, totally naive. it was kind of a very different situation because it was, the singer's brother managed the band. So they kind of controlled everything, but they had all this mountain of gear. It was really nice kind of walking into the situation. It's like, here's all these guitars to use. Here's like, six Marshall stacks. And they just had this big, production company that they own all the stuff and did everything. And I thought that's great. That'll be good. Everybody's looking out for the best interest. And as the years go by, I'm seeing a lot of signs. And then it's like you're hearing it in your ear from the other band members. And what turned out was so great ended up just, really becoming a bad situation after about 4 or 5 years. And I was just like, I got to get out of this. Because they controlled everything. So you couldn't question anything. You couldn't, it was always a lot of tension. And then, it's too bad because it was a really, really good band. And there was a lot of things that could have been done, that we would, other band members would bring up. What do we do this? And then you're always met with resistance. And it was just like, it got to a point where it's like, okay, I think you better start looking at some other options. So it was 8 years. I look back, I go, God, I can't believe it was in that band for 8 years. My sister in the mid to late 90s was living in LA, and I would start going out there every Christmas. And it was, getting where I was like, I really need to move to LA. This is where I need to be. Hands down, without a doubt, I need to be in LA. So that's how that thing kind of fell into place.
Yeah, because on the internet, I know it says that part of the reason that you moved on was deferring opinions about the whole Mojo Gurus direction and stuff like that.
Yeah, I wasn't down with that. And we would play out like that live, and people would just kind of be looking at it, scratching their heads, and it just less and less people showing up. And, I look back and go, okay, well, it's such a weird time in music anyways, like 97, 98. And I had suggested, doing the whole kind of New York Dolls thing, a 3-chord kind of punk rock, blues. And Kevin was like, yeah, totally, totally. Cause all these bands like, American Pearl and Buck Cherry and bands like that and Lit were coming out and had this punky edge, but it was like basically, blues based hard rock with, kind of punk attitude. And I'm like, this is what we should do. And that caught on. And then, it turned into this swamp hillbilly thing. And I was just like, I'm not into that.
Now, I do have to give Roxgang credit. I don't know if you had anything to do with it, but for the name of the album, Bodacious Tatas, because that's best ever.
That was all Kevin. Kevin always had, he's a great lyric writer. He always had great titles. He was very, very clever with words and stuff like that. And he had that name kicking around for a long, long time. And that's a cool name. Yeah.
That's a great name. Like I say, first album, I kind of would figure that you're kind of just told what to do, but it doesn't sound like that changed much over the years. Like that's what sounds almost surprising is, of course, you come in, you're the youngest guy, you're the new member, you're going to do what they're told, but they never accepted your opinion even as time went on, it sounds like. Kevin, I guess. Is it Kevin Steele? Is that his last name?
Yeah, it was always his band, his songs. I'll give credit where credit due. He's a great songwriter, great lyric writer. But after a while, it's just you can't run a band. There's like 4 or 5 other guys that have opinions, that have good stuff they want to bring in. And it was always this headbutting resistance. And, of course, that's why it became such a revolving door where it was like people's like, I'm not doing this. And, I mean, the fact that I lasted 8 years, I look back, I'm very grateful for the gig. And there were a lot of good shows and some good memories, but I look back and go, well, it's too bad that was there was such those factors of, you know, that resistance and, you know, being in that controlled environment. And I can speak for myself, that doesn't work for me. You know, I'm a guy that likes to cherish when we all work as a family, or, you know, you have people that you can bounce ideas off to, that you can talk to, and instead of being screamed at, you know, just that gets old quick.
Now, the band was located in Florida. Was there, were you ever mm-hmm. pushing, was anybody ever pushing for them to get out to L.A.? Maybe that would have been just the change of scenery would have helped the band?
Yeah, I was always trying to do that. And it's funny because after I left the band, they started doing that. it was funny. I was driving down Sunset one time and I'm like driving past the Viper and I'm like, what? Mojo Gurus? What? Hey, what? so that's kind of a funny story. Yeah, you know, I look back and go, you know, those first years were really cool and great shows, packed shows. And it was, you know, well-run organization. And, unfortunately I think maybe too involved with, you know, Kevin and Brett being the controlling, you know, as a family. And sometimes that you might think is a good thing, but sometimes it's not a good thing. And then people start resenting, you know, and then, like I said, you get that revolving door thing going on, and it breaks up any strides that you make or chemistry. You know, once Robbie left, Robbie Strine, I was just really bummed to see him go. Cause him and I were like, when I first joined the band, him and I were like, we were just, you know, together, like we were a team, and it was like we were always the ones getting into trouble and stuff like that. So I was kind of bummed when he left, and then it just progressively was another guy, and it gets to a point where it's like, I think this is enough, you know. You know, again, very grateful for the gig and had some good years down there and made some pretty good music with them, and yeah, so it was a great band.
Well, you know, and I know from my personal experience that you never want to work with a guy named Brett. They're all assholes.
It's no, true.
You said it, not me.
Well, it's funny, though, because you talk about, like, the revolving door. So you went from that revolving door to L.A. Guns, which has had a lot of members. I mean, less so than Tracy Guns has had, has had members. But, you know, so how did that come about?
Well, I had been in L.A. already for about a year. Almost 2 years, actually, and you know, getting to know people in the scene there and stuff. And a friend of mine named Kef, he was a mutual friend of Phil's, and he had called me out of the blue and said, you know, LA Guns looking for a guitar player. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah, are you interested? And I was like, of course. And it's funny because at that time, I really had left all that 80s metal stuff behind. You know, I was really into punk rock at the time and alternative music. It really wasn't doing anything remotely that style. So for a moment I had to almost think about it and then go, okay, this is, why am I thinking about this? This is a great opportunity. This is a band that I always loved, always respected. It would be silly not to pursue it. So we had lunch, I think, with Phil and Steve and set up a time to play together, and it was really just amazing chemistry off the bat. It just really gelled with the band, and that first time was like, okay, you got the gig. I was like, wow, just out of nowhere, you know. And it was like a week later I'm in the band. I was like, wow, okay, let's do this, you know. It's like what a journey, you know. And then 10 years in that band and 4 or 5 records, and it was, you know, a big part of my life.
8 years with Rock Band and 10 with them. Nobody can say you aren't loyal. That's for certain.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most impressive things actually about your resume. And when we kind of look at it from the outside, it's like, oh, yeah, well, this guy's, you know, he sticks with the band. I mean, he gets to know, you make the contribution, obviously, when you spend that much time
with
the
band. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when it's like I really dig something or really get involved with it, I really put everything into it. I totally put all my body and my mind and my soul and my blood, sweat, and tears into it. So, you know, fast forwarding after, you know, in 2012, you know, all those things that kind of, you know, just got flushed down the toilet. And I was, again, being met with a lot of resistance with my guitar playing and personal stuff and, you know, again, the business and all that stuff. And it got to a point where it was like, I can't stay in this band anymore because it doesn't agree with everything that I stand for. And I had to walk away from that. And that was a very big decision. That was not an easy decision to do because that had been my career, touring the world, you know, 8 times over that 10-year period and making records. That was my living. So to walk away from that, that was a big thing. But, you know, you get to a point where it's like you have to do what's right for yourself. And that's how that happened. I couldn't stay in that band any longer.
And, you know, I truly believe you find the work environment, the friends, the loved ones that you needed that time to grow, that they're there to teach you the lessons that you need to grow and evolve from, you know, that instinctively you just find them when you need them. And when you don't need them anymore, then you'll find someone else. It's kind of, you know, it seems to me that's the case. I mean, Roxanne got you prepared for LA Guns. LA Guns mm-hmm. is prepared for this next journey, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, while all those, you know, years, it was like, I loved being in the band, and I never thought I would have left the band. But, you know, when you're almost physically fighting and exchanging stuff that's, you know, very harsh, I just have that switch. It's like, you know, when you get to that point, it's like, you're coming at me like that, you're done. I'm done. There's no edit. I'm just, bye. You know, I'm just that way. So, you know, that starts accumulating, and there's only so much of that stuff you can sweep under the carpet where you go, you know what? I gotta move on. So, again, very, very grateful for my time in the band. I made some amazing records with them. We were like a machine, you know, those years that Adam and Scotty Griffin were in the band, we were a machine. And I think that those lineups you cannot deny those two lineups. As good as the original lineup, I think, and you know, those records that we made, Tales from the Strip, Hollywood Forever, rips the covers off, very, very, you know, respectable, amazing records.
Now, how did you, because I know it was about 5 days after you announced, I think it was on your Facebook, was that right, that you announced that you were leaving LA Guns?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. 5 days later, they had a new, so had you, I guess you had told them beforehand, or do you think they knew, like, how did that kind of, did you just go, did you call somebody, or did you kind of get everybody together and let them know, or how did that kind of go down?
It had been building up, and you know, they kind of sensed it and I sensed it, and you know, it kind of came to a head one night, and very explosively one night in Sweden. And I was just like, the next day I was just like, hey guys, I'm done, I'm leaving, you know. When it gets to that point, it's like with any job, you know, it's like when you're screaming and yelling at each other and, you know, cursing each other out and, you know, degrading someone as a human being. And it's been, you know, there have been other moments like that. It's very dysfunctional. You can't stay in something like that. And for me to have respect for myself was like, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to continue and work with people who don't respect me anymore and vice versa. And it's unfortunate because the band was so good, and I think I suited the band very, very well. You know, there's a reason why Scotty and I are not in the band anymore. So it's, you know, it's all part of being in a band. It's a, you know, very dysfunctional job, and it's you know. It amazes me when there's bands that stay together for 30 years with the original lineups. It's just like, you know, that amazes me because it's like, you know, there's so much to deal with. It's like family, and you fight with your family, and sometimes you don't even talk to your family.
I can't help but think of Keith Richards' book that came out a couple of years ago, and like 80% of the book is him insulting the shit out of Mick Jagger, and they're out
right.
playing again, you know, touring together next year. It's like I can't.
Oh,
imagine.
It's so dysfunctional. Yeah, it really is. You know. But you know, all good. Again, look back on my time and many great moments, many great memories, and very proud of what I accomplished with the band. And you know, I kind of left on a high note, you know, so to speak. And I think if I hadn't left, I probably would have been fired, just because of the, you know, too many differences, so to speak. And that kind of started coming up when we were making the Hollywood Forever record. It was a lot of headbutting, and you know, I was going in a different direction, you know, musically and with my guitar playing too, which didn't kind of caused some headbutting as well. So it kind of started that beginning of that year and just progressed. But, you know, these things happen, and you move on, you pick yourself up, and you rebuild yourself, and you just, you know, again, you, like that shark, you keep swimming, and you just keep, fighting upstream until you break down that door of something else that you're trying to accomplish.
So I've got a couple of questions. One of them is now, like, at that, near the end, now, did anything start spilling out onto the stage, or was that always kind of a professional zone? Because I know that we've seen some shows before where you can tell that the band members are fuming, but
yeah,
one of them was trying to be professional, and some are not.
There was quite a few times where Phil and I just contempt for each other on stage. You know, and it's funny. I remember we were playing at the AVA Amphitheater in Tucson, Arizona, with Warrant and Skid Row. And I remember Robert Mason saying to me, it's like, damn, man, you're going to come to tension between you and Phil with a butter knife, you know? And I said, yeah, a little bit. But, you know, I can laugh about it now, you know, but that happens. That happens with, you know, you ask any band, you know, they're usually sometimes throwing fists at each other on stage, so...
And so then the other question that I wanted to ask is about, you know, when you talk about recording Hollywood Forever, and I'm interested because, you know, LA Guns, and especially a lot of the bands that from that age that are coming back and still playing now, is there kind of a box that people want them to go into? And is that part of, you know, trying to keep your playing the way it was at the beginning, is just trying to keep LA Guns in a box where it's always just LA Guns music?
Well, you know, I was, you know, especially with Scotty and I was always pushing them to do other stuff, to do from different albums, you know, and of course there was the staple of songs you had to play, and that goes regardless, that goes with any successful band. But I was always trying to get them to do stuff like, you know, different stuff up, like, you know, Hollywood Vampires and stuff like that. And it was actually Scotty's idea to do in 2009 to do the entire album of Cocked and Loaded, and we did that, and we did it great. So we were always trying to think of things like that maybe Phil and Steve wouldn't have thought of, because we were the young guys, you know, we were still kind of fans in a sense. So I was always trying to push that element into the band as well.
So how much input did you have on the covers albums that you were a part of?
Well, I had just more or less joined the band in late 2003, so they already had that in the works. So it was just diving right into those songs, and then, you know, let's have an open mind of what we can do on that stuff. And I think it was a great avenue for me to gel with the band, with the cover record. And, you know, Andy Johns had produced that record too. So we had some really fun, and we got to kind of know each other. And it was a perfect way to start with the band and playing recording those cover songs, which was like Bowie and Zeppelin. And we did, what else did we do? Hanoi Rocks and Saxon. It was a great, great fun time to do that record. And then we went on a big long tour to Europe after that and really gelled off the band. And then I think we really hit our stride with me when we toured with Doc in that summer in 2004. And that was a fantastic, fantastic time. Just a great time. Fun tour. Very successful.
You know, it seems like it's from the outside, it seemed like you guys, you know, you were a great fit and everything's going great. Everything's going great. And then like a switch went. You know, it's a strange thing because, I mean, it seemed like even just a little bit before that, I mean, to the outside, it seemed like the band seemed tight. But I kind of want to go back to more a little bit. I don't want to talk about so much about what happened with, you know, Tracy Guns starting his own version of L.A. Guns. And that's been talked to death. I'm more interested, though, if you, like, he said a lot of shit about you and you never did a thing to him. Like, you, all you did was go in and play and take a job. Doing music that you liked, you know, or loved.
Yeah.
Like, you never did a thing to him, and yet he would say all this stuff about you and for no reason. But did you ever have any interaction with him during this period, or himself? Did you ever talk or avoid each other?
No, not at all. I have only met him twice, and when I first joined the band, he was very nice to me, and then I guess 3 years ago, very conflict with him in a room. So, you know, that's on him. I if people want to react or don't like me, I really don't give a shit. I am who I am.
Love that.
I treat people with respect, and I'm, you know, very courteous, and I'm courteous to the fans, and I'm very kind to people because that's the way I want to be treated. So if people want to talk shit, if he wants to talk shit or flip out in a room because I'm standing beside him, it just makes him look like a fool. So I'm not going to go on the attack and, you know, go into press and, or if he, whoever it is, if they don't have something bad to say about me, the press is like, you're entitled to your opinion. But at the end of the day, all I can be is a decent person and be a great musician and let that do all the talking for me.
With the LA Guns and the Sunset Strip. Now, were you there at a point where some of the crazy action was going on the strip, or was that a little more in the latter period? Because I know your LA Guns records were very much focused on like being a part of the strip and just being, you know, that band.
Yeah, you know, I went out there in the late 80s when I was still living in Toronto. It was, you know, amazing. It was everything I'd read about, and gosh, what a cool time to be there. And just even having a small glimpse of that for like a couple of weeks was just so cool. But everybody had their little Sunset Strip in their cities. And I just remember, like, in the late 80s and early 90s in Toronto, like 1991, fantastic scene there too. So everybody kind of, you know, copied what was going on in LA, and they had their, you know, any big city had their own little strip vibe. But was fortunate to be out there for a little bit and at that time and saw that and, you know, go out to the clubs and hang out and, you know, see all that. It was amazing. And I don't think we'll ever see that again. That was a movement, and an incredible movement.
Were there any clubs that you preferred over some of the others?
You know, Gazzari's was just so cool. That was a really cool club. And, of course, the Rainbow was always great. And you know, it's funny because now when you go to L.A., it's just this kind of shadow of its former self. And it was cool because there was a kind of a resurgence back in 2007, 8, 9, 10, and 11. It was kind of that 20-year cycle. And it was like kind of fortunate to catch the last little great hurrah in L.A. Now when I go back there, it's just, wow, it's just changed so much. It's kind of a bummer, you know, because you had a lot of great, great, great times in that city.
Yeah, there's a lot of nostalgia for, I mean, I think we're just a couple of years younger than you. A lot of nostalgia for that age and that, you know. And Yeah, I mean, I kind of wondered, do you, I mean, you got there, like you say, you got there, kind of saw it a little bit, but do you ever get any stories from somebody about some crazy incidences in the mid-80s and that type of thing where you just thought, that's a great story, that's just amazing. I wish I could have been there for all that.
Yeah, I mean, I think anybody that was in the scene and playing the circuit and in it was just like, it was, you know, you can't recreate that. That's a once in a lifetime experience, whether you became successful or not. But if you were in it, you know, you could live in it. An amazing time period in just in general, but in that city, in that scene. Like the likes we'll probably never see again. I mean, who knows? Maybe we will, but something to be said about that.
You have a favorite story from that that somebody told you that you can share, and you don't have to drop names if you don't have to, but just a story that you're like, that's awesome. That's.
Yeah, I, you know, it's very X-rated, most of
Go ahead. It's a podcast. It's
Well, save it,
not
for
censored.
your imaginations, you know. I mean, it was just everybody that was involved in the scene, it was just wild times, you know, people having sex in dumpsters and, you know, blowjobs behind the Roxy and stuff like that. So it was the Wild West back then. I mean, you know. Yeah, I think that's why it's like, you know, people talk about it. It's such, you know, zest when you talk about those days, because it was like kind of, it was anything went, you know. It was the 80s. It was like the economy was booming. It was just, fashion was awesome. Music was amazing. You know, it was just this everything, you know, it was wild. You know, if you were part of it, you probably don't remember most of it anyways, but
You know, I hear the guys talk about it. It's like they have the, it's like this combination usually from, you know, guys talking about it. It's almost like, man, I wish I could go back there, but on the other hand, I'm sure as hell glad it's over. Like, at the same time, you know, almost like this, like it can't be like that. You can't live like that forever. But I
no,
kind
and
of.
you know, and it, yeah, and it was like there was the, you know, times when Scotty and I, you know, were the partiers in LA Guns, and you know, we would just, we were like Rip Taylor, you know. We were just having the time of our lives, and like it was kind of like a little resurgence of that era, so to speak. And but now it's just like there's just no way I could do it. You know, it's like I'm 48. It's like, you know, when I play a show, I go back to my hotel room and I'm just like, oh God, I'm tired, you know. My leg hurts, my back, you know, what happened? So,
It sucks.
yeah, those days are long gone. Yeah.
So what are some of your favorite places to play, like in the world then? Because you said that you've been around the world 8 times with LA Guns, and so
Yeah.
you must have seen some really, really exciting places.
Yeah, very, very grateful for that. Very fortunate, blessed to have done that many, many times. You know, Australia, playing in Sydney and you know, places like that, in Tokyo, amazing. Playing in Stockholm, Sweden, and Helsinki, Finland. Again, highlights. You know, one of my favorite places to play in America is Minneapolis. It's one of my favorite cities. I have so many great friends there, and every show, always packed, and just a great community there of music and bands. So that's always one of my favorite places to go to and play. But you know, around the world, definitely Australia, Japan, playing in London, always a great city. Vancouver, just so many great places to go to, yeah, that I've really, really had the fortune
Well, you
to
mentioned one Canadian city there.
play several times.
I was starting to wonder if you're going to mention any Canadian cities. And any good stories of touring Canada? Since that's where we're, you know, since you're
Yeah,
Calgary,
actually,
born and
in
raised.
Calgary, and we were talking about this before
Shh, don't
the
tell them that part.
interviews started.
That.
I can't remember exactly where we played, but I remember the bus was parked in the back of this club, and there was an apartment. There was big apartment buildings across the street. And I remember this drunk guy, maybe in his 20s, late 20s, early 30s, just kept messing with us. And I remember at one point, like he took his pants down, he was rubbing his ass on the windshield of the bus. how he got it up that high, I don't know, but he did. And we're just all looking. I'm like, oh, dude, are you serious? Like, we're going to beat ass. So then they started chucking like water balloons from their balcony, and they were like screaming at us, just like, go back to Texas. Like, okay. That is, why Texas? Yeah. You guys got something against Texas or something?
Not that I know of.
So
I thought Alberta was supposed to be the Texas of Canada earlier.
Yeah, I guess. So this went on for almost a couple of hours. So we were waiting. The gig was done, and we were waiting for the bus driver to get back. So we got word that he was on his way back. And I remember Adam Hamilton, who was a bass player at the time, he had bought this really kick-ass paintball gun. I can't remember where he got it. He's like, I have an idea. So we turned off all the lights in the bus, and we waited for our driver to get back. And this guy was still messing with us. So we told him, we would say go floor the bus. So Adam kind of crouched down. He cracked the window open. And he crouched down one of the tables, couch boards, whatever. And he like cracked the window, and he had this paintball gun. He just lit this guy up. He was like, dup, 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 dup. And like, go. And the bus sped off, and I was like, okay, you got what you deserved.
It's awesome. That is great.
That's my Calgary story.
Well, that is a great Calgary story. So,
yeah, I'm really sorry about that thing with my ass, by the way.
Oh, that was you. Okay. Yeah,
yeah. There's no way
you get those paint stains out of your clothes.
So it obviously takes a special person to be able to go out on tour and do this job constantly. Like, what is it that makes you different and able to do that kind of thing?
I think it's just a way of life. It's like what I do. It's like I play music for a living. I have for decades, and I don't know really how to do anything else. I mean, I have other things that I do, but once you have that mindset, it's like swimming, or it's like walking. It's just, you know, it's what you do. You get into that mindset. It's like, okay, I got to be at the airport at this time. You know, you get into that tour mode. And it's not easy, you know, the time changes and all the flights. I remember one year, I think I calculated in 2011, I think we took like about 100 flights with LA Guns. We had done this endless, constant touring. I was like for a year solid. And I think we had at one point gone around the world. We'd literally gone from LA around and back to LA, and it will take a toll on you. Definitely. You just start spacing out. You don't know where you are half the time. I remember coming back from Sweden one time, and I was literally 3 days later, I was in a hotel room, and I think we were playing at San Diego, near San Diego or something like that. And I remember being in my hotel room switching TV station. I'm like, I can't believe all the American stations that they're getting in this hotel room. And I thought it was still in Europe. Like, you have this displacement of time. It's really weird when you're really touring that much. But you got to be careful, you know. And the older you get, it'll affect you. You know, I started getting really bad sciatica in my left leg, and that was brutal. You know, I had that going back to 2009, and that was really tough. It would wear on me doing these excessive long tours and fly dates and stuff like that. And when you're dealing with, you know, back pain and stuff like that, it can get the better of you. So, it's a tough job. It's the best job in the world, but it's not always easy.
Is that one of the reasons that you kind of decided to bring it into the Let It Rock, section? Is just to kind of, tour less, but still keep playing?
No, you know, it's like I really wanted that to tour a lot more than it has, but the problem with that was always because of everybody, because it's an all-star band. Everybody else is in different bands, working bands too. So that was limited in what we could do from, you know, point A to point B over the course of 12 months. So we tried to tour as much as we could with that, but it was such a, you know, such a good lineup that I didn't really want to deviate too much with that band, because it's like when you see Oz and Jimmy and Jamie and Sean and myself or Jeff Duncan on stage, it's just this incredible magic that this band has. So, you know, swapping out people every week, it just didn't make sense to me. So that was one of the reasons why we weren't able to tour as much as we were. And also too, we had not a very good booking agent, that didn't help either. So that's why I, you know, wasn't going out full throttle, like I normally would. But there was a time I took a year off, 2013, because I was just so fried from all those years in LA Guns.
Now, the spelling, R-A-W-K, Let It mm-hmm. Rock. Is that mm-hmm. just because that sounded so, once again, so, I don't know, metal? Is that, how did you come up with that name?
I just came to me one day, I'm like, that's how it's going to, I'm going to do it like that, just to be different. And, you know, it just kind of stuck. And, you know, it was a lot of work to get that thing off the ground. You know, there was many man hours that went into it, but it's a really fun band, and we've got some shows coming up next week, actually, and haven't seen the guys in quite a while, so it'd be good to do that. Of course, want to mention the new band that I'm in called Angels in Fame that is really, really blowing up right now. That's going to start taking off in this fall, so we're excited about that too.
Yeah, that's V-E-I-N for people to mm-hmm. Google it. Yep. Angels in Vain.
Yes,
that's right. Looking for the song 1973, which I heard was going to be the first one, but I think there's a different song that's available that's out there already.
Yeah, pre-single. People were demanding music so much. You know, it really kind of took us off guard, the response that this band got, which again is Chris Von Dahl, Eric Stacey, Taz Anthony, and Troy Patrick Farrell, and myself. That is Angels in Vain. So we were like, we need to release some music because, you know, we had filmed the video for 1973, and it's, of course, taking a little bit of time to have it edited and make it great because we want it to be great. So we were like, well, let's release a pre-single, and that was a song called No One Gets Out Alive, and that really got a great response, too. So it's kind of different than anything I've done before. It's a little bit heavier and has more of a kind of modern sound, I suppose, if that makes any sense. What is modern sound?
You know? No, I know what you mean.
Kind of got a heavier vibe to it with, like, detuning and stuff like that, but the songs are great, and we're excited to begin with it at the beginning of the fall.
Is this the most kind of you've taken charge of the songwriting in a band? Is this the most that you've done, or is it kind of, you know, is it a real collaboration, or how is it working?
Well, Chris and Taz have been writing the majority of the stuff, but again, it's a brand new band, so we're always trying to get together and write new stuff and record new stuff, and they kind of bounce ideas, or they'll send me ideas. Hey, what do you think of this? And I'll try to maybe manipulate it, or sometimes it's just a finished thing. I'm like, this is great the way it is. Don't touch it. But I always try to write as much as possible. I did quite a bit of writing with LA Guns too. You know, I had three or four songs that I brought into Hollywood Forever, and Hollywood Forever, Vine Street Shimmy, and Venus Palm made the record, and the fourth one I brought in was actually a bonus track on the Japanese release called Rattlesnake, and that's a song that I actually brought into Let It Rock that we do.
I think that's on SoundCloud from your website, Rattlesnake. I think I mm-hmm. got a chance to listen to that.
It could
one.
Be, yes.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. Yeah. Were you, these songs that you're kind of off your website on SoundCloud, are you singing the vocals on them?
No.
No?
Okay. I wish I could sing, but I'm not a strong singer. not lead vocals anyways, but another great thing about Let It Rock is there's, you know, four guys in this band that can really, really sing. So when we do background vocals, it's just epic, you know. And Oz is fantastic background singer. I mean, he'll blow your ears out at soundcheck just checking his mic. And Sean's excellent as well. So between, you know, the four of us, we really move some space on stage.
Right. Because I had seen a YouTube clip of Let It Rock playing one of the Striper songs, and I was very surprised by Oz with the vocals that he was kind of co-singing with Jamie there.
Yeah, he's got a strong voice, and he's amazing.
So, I mean, who are some of the players that influenced you or that you really like that people might not expect?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, lately over the last like year or so, I've been really getting into a lot of blues fusion, and I just, you know, I'll find myself getting just lost for hours playing that stuff over backing tracks. That's something I'd really love to do maybe in the next year or a couple of years is do instrumental record like that. So some people might be not expect something like that from me. I'm always trying to look for new guitar players to get into. Of course, I have my staples, but Neil Sean's there. I love his playing, and I get a lot of that kind of blues fusion kind of style from him. Neil Giraldo from Pat Benatar, amazing guitar player. Always loved his playing. But then I have my staples of Jimmy Page and Randy Rhoads and all that stuff.
So then I guess this is a great time to talk about Symphonic Slam because you did that back, what was it, 2008? Was it?
Nine.
Nine, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what made you decide that you were going to do that?
But before you answer that, I just want to say I knew it was 2009.
Oh, fair.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Yeah. Go ahead.
That started as a session that Brian from Cleopatra Records, we actually did a Christmas record, and it was a track that I did played on Greensleeves, and it really turned out amazing. I mean, amazing, and Adam Hamilton produced it. And when Brian heard that, he was like, wow, he goes, we got to do a whole record like this. So it's actually all original classical pieces from Bach, Strauss, Beethoven. So there's all of those songs that are rocked out with the orchestration. So there's like 1812 Overture, Moonlight Sonata, Blue Danube, Air on a G-String, also Sprach Zarathustra, those type of songs. So that was an amazing experience because it really focused on your guitar being your voice as opposed to just, okay, just solo for 4 minutes, you know. There was tracks like that, but there was a lot of thought and a lot of preparation that would go into that. And Adam, you know, was a machine on that record. He played bass drums and did all the orchestration. So he'd be throwing all of these, you know, files at me. Here's the orchestration for this. And I'd have to come up with like the, you know, you think of your guitar as your voice. So you create a melody for your verse, your pre-chorus and so forth. So there's a lot of different process of recording with that mentality, which was very different than opposed to doing a record with Rocks, Gang, or LA Guns. So it was a very cool experience. And it actually, you know, it made me a better guitar player.
I actually kind of wonder when I saw that, I'm like, is he practicing so he can join Trans-Siberian Orchestra or something? I thought, yeah, maybe we just get him out there one tour with him. That'd be fun.
Yeah, yeah. It was a lot of man hours that went into that album. So it was a great experience. Yeah, it turned out great.
Now you brought up the idea of it's time for a guitar solo, but what makes a great guitar solo?
I think just voicing and phrasing and, you know, a little bit of technicality. There's so many, you're going to get so many different answers from different guitar players. You know, one of the best solos ever is the solo from Comfortably Numb, Pink Floyd, David Gilmour. I mean, that solo is a song in itself. So there's that. I really love that style, but then I really like, you know, stuff that's very bombastic, like the early Eddie Van Halen stuff and the Randy Rhoads stuff, which has a very, you know, neoclassical feel to it. which gave it a very, you know, cutting edge sound. So I never limited myself to just one style of guitar playing. I like so many different types of players, and I think that was, I'm always evolving as a guitar player, whereas some guys, they kind of just peak out and they stay linear. So I think that had a lot to do with me leaving the LA Guns as well. My style of playing, it was changing drastically. And, you know, sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't work over the music. So, that's one thing for me. It was like, I'm always trying to strive to be a better musician.
Now, actually, you brought up LA Guns again. That reminds me of one question I kind of wanted to ask about it that I didn't get a chance to before. And it's just, now we're seeing Phil and Tracy playing, I think, about 5 or 6 shows this year and saying they're probably going to tour together in 2017. And the quote from Tracy Guns was, well, we were never really without all that hostile. It was just a cat fight the whole time. It was never really anything that serious. And you were there. Was it really never that serious? It seemed, didn't seem that way. What do you think about that?
I was, you know, surprised to kind of hear that. I mean, for 10 years, I just saw these guys just going at each other constantly. Constantly. But, I mean, you know, good for them that they made up and buried that hatchet. And, you know, for everything that they've done and accomplished, you know, it's good to see that they are. That they did make amends, because, you know, they did a lot of great things together. So
it's good for the fans.
You know, for the fans, if the fans dig it, I don't know. But I mean, you know, the fact that they made the effort to kind of make up I would never see that just from what I experienced over 10 years.
Now,
I think it's great.
Okay, cool. Talking about some people you might have known, also, obviously, you knew Andy Johns quite well, just a legendary producer. I wonder if you might have a story or two about that he told you about working with, I don't know, Zeppelin or the Stones or Rod Stewart, or Eric Clapton or Van Halen or there's a Humble Pie or Cinderella. I don't know, but that guy, amazing, right?
Just endless stories. And it was great to always be around people that worked with Andy, because then you would share their stories. And I remember we had played this big, big show with Cinderella, and we were all at the hotel, I think, that day and eating breakfast and talking with Fred Grew, who's a very good friend of mine, and I was talking with Tom, and we were talking about Andy. And he was sitting there. We're doing the first record, and Tom Kiefer was laying down a solo, I don't know, on one song, and, you know, Andy was like, you know, hovering over him with, you know, cigarette dangling and just like wheezing. He's like, let's talk about the Simple, you know, which is like, I've seen Andy, you know, in that kind of mode before. So it was always great to share stories with people that, you know, would lay their stories of recording records with him. And he was just an amazing entity. And just had so many great memories with Andy, and him and I became very close, and was just gutted when he passed away, you know, just devastated. And
it was an ulcer, wasn't it?
Well, his body had, you know, he'd done a lot of damage to his body for several decades, you know, living you know, one big celebration. And, you know, you were not invincible. So it's unfortunate that he went so quick. And I remember I was the last person to actually record with him. I was doing a session with this guy from New Orleans, and you know, he went in the hospital, and 10 days later he was gone. So that was tough. That was really tough. And but yeah, so many great stories. You know, he would tell us about, you know, stuff with Nick and Keith and you know, recording Stairway to Heaven, you know. I mean, it's just epic. You know, he was like, tell us about when, you know, Page laid down the solo for Stairway to Heaven. You know, and he's like, oh, you know, he's like, I was looking at him through the glass, and Jimmy was like, why are you looking at me like that? You know, and then Andy was like, I'm not looking at you. And they said we went back and forth for like 10 minutes and they were like, you know, stressing each other out. So it was all these little stories like that, or, and, you know, a recording in the south of France with the Stones or Jack Bruce, or, you know, working at the record plant. It was just, the guy was incredible, incredible person. Just nobody like him ever. You know, I was just blessed to have done all those records I did with him, and all the time that we spent, and you know, we got to hang out with him on several social occasions over at his house for barbecues and Christmas parties, and just a wonderful guy. I miss him dearly.
It sounds like somebody could interview people just for stories from him, about him, and put together a great book, and that's pretty cool. And somebody else that that I'm sure you must have met some, or talked to some, or known to some degree, or have some thoughts on, because we're coming upon, I was a huge fan and a huge influence on me, and we're coming upon the 5-year anniversary, unbelievably, this August, of his passing, and that's Janie Lane. Do you have any Janie Lane stories that that maybe you can share with me?
Jane is just the sweetest guy, you know, just always, you know, we would see you, he's like, he would just, you know, always remember your name, no matter what, he was tired or whatever the case may be. And just a great, sweet guy. And, we did some shows with him, and he was just always, you know, very, very, very pleasant to be around. And, unfortunate, you know, it just had that alcoholic demon and addiction in him, and which is just, that is pretty prevalent in a lot of guys from our era. And so sad, very talented guy, but always just a sweet guy, you know. That's how I remember Janie.
So who were some of your favorite people to play with then over the years?
Gosh, there's so many. All of the Warrant guys, just amazing, great guys, good friends, always loved touring with them. The Cinderella guys, great guys as well. All the guys in Rat, you know, Skid Row, fun guys. Just a lot of great years touring with a lot of those bands.
Who's the single funniest guy that you ever thought?
I think Wild Mick Brown. Definitely the Rodney Dangerfield, the Rock guy. He's, what a character, man. I love Mick. Had so much fun with him at shows and on tour, and just what a ride. There's a guy that loves life, man. It just every day with a huge smile on his face, and he just is like, no matter what, man, I'm going to enjoy myself.
Got one story for him then?
Yeah, you know, we always used to do this thing. We would have these video game nights in the back of their bus, and he would always make White Russians. It wasn't anything else. You couldn't drink anything else. You had to drink White Russians. And playing Xbox Grand Prix, and just he would just see a golf cart or something, you know, backstage at a festival, and he would just grab you and throw you in it, and he would just, you know, drive the thing like sadistically throughout the grounds, and, you know, stuff like that. He was always having a blast. So being around him was always just fun. And I remember one time, I think it was the M3 Festival, staying at the Sheraton Hotel, and him and I were we were totally buzzed, you know, afterwards. And well, I think we were reenacting a scene from one of the Pink Panther movies and stuff, and everybody's just kind of looking at us like, wow, what's wrong with you guys, you know? And we're just laughing our asses off. We're doing this slow motion karate stuff, you know, from Pink Panther movies. Just, yeah, always a great time with that guy. I love him.
Awesome. And we're kind of probably nearing the end here. I'm wondering, as a Calgarian born and raised, you've lived here your whole life. As a Calgarian, maybe as a Canadian, what is a Canadian band or two that you think people haven't heard that they should check out?
Boy, there were so many. There was a lot of kind of obscure bands that I was into, really into this band. And so is like Brent Fitz and Todd Kearns from Slash's band. It's a band called Orphan. They were on Portrait Records, CBS 83, 85. They only put out two records. I believe Tony Platt produced them, or the first one was him and John Bon Jovi's brother. And that's a great band. They only put out two records. Night Parade and Salute. I believe the second record is called that. That was a great band. Another great band, late 80s, early 90s, with a female singer called National Velvet on Capitol Records. Really cool band. Most of the other bands, the Canadian rock was very, you know, it was very AOR. You know, it always had, any hard rock band that came out, always had the keyboards in them. I was really liked that the first Brighton Rock record that came out in 86. And Michael Wagner produced that. It's a great sounding record. Geez, what else? Back. Of course, I'm a huge Max Webster fan.
Hey, Kim Mitchell.
Yeah, rip guitar player too. And a number of great solo records that he put out too in 84, 85. I was way, way into Max Webster. Still am, still listen to. April Wine, you know, not so obscure. And then, you know, I grew up on all that stuff. It was a staple listening to Triumph and, you know, Saga and April Wine and Helix and all, you know, all of that stuff.
Well, and you kind of played in that neighborhood in Toronto. So, I mean, did you play with some of those bands like Helix or Saga?
No, you know, they, I started playing the circuit in Toronto around 87, 86, 87, somewhere around there. So those bands had already well, you know, surpassed that time were you know, doing other big, bigger things, but, you know, primarily did the circuit around Toronto and Ontario. And, then, you know, like I said, early 90s, I moved down to Florida for Rockscape.
Now, we probably should wrap it up here for you, though. So we'll give you a chance to plug anything you want to plug and just get it out there. But we're wondering if there might be a song that you'd want us to put on or you know that you have the rights to for us to put on that that would be okay or anything like that.
Yeah. You know, I'll send you guys No One Gets Out Alive and also American Rebels from Let It Rock, which we put out a couple years ago. Great, great song.
It is.
And that's on iTunes as well. Both are. So yeah, just, you know, still got Let It Rock going. A great band. We do play out and watch for some, you know, big things with Angels in Vain. We've got angelsinvain.com. Got some great new merchandise from that. You know, we've got the Twitter page and Facebook page, Angels in Vain, and we'll start touring with that probably around the beginning of October. That's the plan with that. So, you know, I'm always staying busy. So just, you know, people can get on my Facebook page, my Twitter, and, you know, I'm always, you know, pushing the social media.
That's awesome, Stacy. We really appreciate your time. And next time we'll bring you back on. We'll talk a little bit about your book. We never even got to. I don't know if you know this. Amazon, it's like going for like $320. So we've never had chance to read it. Oh, it's ridiculous. Yeah, like all the copies are like $300 or plus. I guess it's rare, but I'd love to.
I think it's out of print now because, yeah, you know, it's been out there for so long. And
2009 for that one as well, right?
Yeah. So yeah. It's crazy to think when you. When you say 2009, it's like, geez, that's 7 years ago.
I know.
What?
But put that on Kindle and we'll read that in a heartbeat. You know,
sure.
That would be awesome. Yeah. Because I mean, you're a great guy. But $300, great. I don't know.
Thank you. Well, us Canadians, you know, we gotta stick together. Gotta say that.
Thank you so much, Stacy.
My pleasure, guys.
Stacy Blades. You know, good luck in the future. I hope you have all the best luck with Angels in Vain and Let It Rock. And we'll talk to you again.
Yes, absolutely. Look forward to it.